something for everyone else but Aboriginal Americans, says Jim Crow Joe Biden. Transylvania University, or is that University of Penn and Princeton? They pull a Geronimo on the bones of stolen victims of MOVE bombing. FDA wants to censor your supplements. Canada issues another travel ban, this time on foreign students. Is AT&T guilty of using cell towers to target unsuspecting Americans? And Elon Musk is already counting bodies for his Mars mission. Dead bodies, that is. All this happening in the roundup of the Balanced Reality Report. Things were delayed by off-again-and-on-again electrical grid here, and by lovely but noisy sounds of nature. However, that did not stop my appointed rounds. So, with that said, we begin.
No, but they look, they're not mutually exclusive. But I can't believe that whatever it is, the African American community would not support what I'm talking about. In addition to,
Let me ask you this, and we can move on because we got to get some phone calls in as well. But let me ask you this then: if in fact a calculation comes to you that you are satisfied with, would you then say I'm for reparations?
The answer is it would depend on what it was, and will it include Native Americans as well?
Vice President Biden, do you support reparations?
Look, let me, since I haven't spoken on this, got a chance. Number one, the reason we're the country we are is because of immigration. We've been able to cherry pick the best from every single continent. The people who come here have determination, resilience. They are ready to stand up and work like the devil. We have 24 out of 100 children in our school today is Hispanic. The idea that we are going to walk away and not provide every opportunity for them is not only stupid and immoral, but it's bad for America. They are the future of America, and we should invest in them. Everybody will benefit from it, every single American. And you should get used to it. This is a nation of immigrants. That's who we are. That's why we're who we are. That's what makes us different, and we should invest in it.
Thank you, Mr. Biden. Senator Klobuchar, you had your hand up.
U.S. President Joe Biden snubs Aboriginal Americans, aka so-called Black Americans, once again, during the last few days of his 100 days in office. Biden has managed to sign 60 executive orders since taking office, primarily aimed at curbing the coronavirus and dismantling many of former President Donald Trump's policies. But none of these signed orders specifically targets Aboriginal Americans for economic empowerment, economic relief, nor protection from race hate as a group. To date, 10 of his 12 actions on immigration are reversals of Trump's policies. He signed his first executive order specifically on gender identity discrimination on the first day of his presidency. Most recently, Biden signed an executive order specifically directing federal agencies to combat racism against Asian American and Pacific Islander communities, plus economic empowerment for those communities. Biden did address racial inequities, however, in his executive order advancing racial equity and support for underserved communities. But as I stated at the top, none of these orders specifically addresses Aboriginal Americans, but instead is another all-inclusive people of color remedy. Moreover, this particular exec order puts nothing tangible into effect, but instead establishes various agencies such as the Domestic Policy Council, or DPC, which will study the issue and file a report after 1 year with a plan on how to proceed. You may recall an allegedly leaked private video conference meeting between Biden, VP Harris, and so-called Black civil rights leaders, where he said he cannot and will not sign executive orders addressing certain Aboriginal issues. Mind you, none of the hand-picked so-called civil rights leaders in the meeting pushed for Aboriginal-specific policies. The following audio is from TheIntercept.com and has been edited for time only.
A completely closed call. So just wanted to remind you of that. There's no recording.
I'm the first person, Black or white, who calls attention to the fact that you were finding that
there was the rate of people who were African Americans were dying was three times that of white people. I don't carry around a stamp on my head saying progressive and I'm AOC, but I have a more of a record of getting things done in the United States Congress than anybody you know. Anybody you know. By 2040, this country is going to be minority white European. Hear me? Minority white European. And you guys are going to have to start working more with Hispanics, who make up a larger portion of the population than y'all do. Let's get something straight. You shouldn't be disappointed. What I've done so far is more than anybody else has done this far. Okay? Number one. Number two, I mean what I say when I say it. There's some things that I'm going to be able to do by executive order. I'm not going to hesitate to do it. But what I'm not going to do is I'm not going to do what used to, Vanita, you probably used to get angry with me during the debates when you'd have some of the people you were supporting said, on day one, I'm going to executive order to do this. Not within the constitutional authority. I am not going to violate the Constitution. There is a Constitution. It's our only hope. Our only hope. And the way to deal with it is where I have executive authority, I will use it to undo every single damn thing this guy has done by executive authority. But I'm not going to exercise executive authority where it's questioned, where I can come along and say, I can do away with assault weapons. There's no executive authority to do away with that. And no one's fought harder to get rid of assault weapons than me. Me. But you can't do it by executive order. If you do that, next guy comes along and says, well, guess what? By executive order, I'm going to say everybody can own machine guns again. So we got to be careful. I know you all know this, but I also don't think we should get too far ahead of ourselves on dealing with police reform in that, because they've already labeled us as being defund the police. Anything we put forward in terms of the organizational structure to change policing, which I promise you will occur. Promise you. Just think to yourself and give me advice whether we should do that before January 5th, because that's how they beat the living hell out of us across the country, saying that we're talking about defunding the police. We're not. We're talking about holding them accountable.
VP Kamala Harris has spoken her share of condescending diatribes and promises to Aboriginals too. In the following audio clips, she skates around the issue of reparations, and in the second audio, which is from 2019 during her campaign for president, she can be heard telling an audience at Al Sharpton's National Action Network conference that she will sign a reparations bill if elected president.
Do you support reparations for Black people?
Well, listen. Again, we had over 200 years of slavery. We had Jim Crow for almost a century. We had legalized discrimination and segregation, and now we have segregation and discrimination that is not legal but still exists and is a barrier to progress. We have disparities around housing. We have disparities around education. We have disparities around income. And we have to recognize that everybody did not start out on an equal footing in this country. And in particular, Black people have not. And so we have got to recognize that and do something about that and give folks a lift up. That's why, for example, I'm proposing the LIFT Act. Give people who are making $100,000 or less as a family a tax credit, which will benefit and uplift 60% of Black families who are in poverty.
So by default, it affects Black families, but there's not a particular policy for African Americans that you would explore.
But no, if you look at the reality of who will benefit from certain policies, when you take into account that they're not starting at the same place and they're not starting on equal footing, it will directly benefit Black children, Black families, Black homeowners, because the disparities are so significant. So if we focus on the specific issues that have resulted in the greatest disparities, and we understand that that's part of why we're doing it. Listen, the reality also is this. Any policy that will benefit Black people will benefit all of society. Let's be clear about that. Let's really be clear about that. So I'm not gonna sit here and say I'm gonna do something that's only gonna benefit Black people. No, because whatever benefits that Black family will benefit that community and society as a whole and the country. Right? Justice
means recognizing domestic terrorism, including white nationalist extremism, from Pittsburgh to Charleston to Orlando, is a threat to the country we love and should be considered a national security priority.
If you elected president, would you sign that bill if it came across your desk?
When I am elected president, I will sign that bill.
They call that turn the beat around. Senator Kamala Harris, thank you.
In Biden's first address to Congress, he addressed many issues, including race. Republican Party response was given by Representative Senator Tim Scott, who followed up Biden's address in a pre-recorded speech on Fox News Network, where he stated, "America is not a racist country," unquote.
Good evening. I'm Senator Tim Scott from the great state of South Carolina. We just heard President Biden's first address to Congress. Our president seems like a good man. His speech was full of good words, but President Biden promised you a specific kind of leadership. He promised to unite a nation, to lower the temperature, to govern for all Americans, no matter how we voted. This was the pitch. You just heard it again. But our nation is starving for more than empty platitudes. We need policies and progress that brings us closer together. But 3 months in, the actions of the president and his party are pulling us further and further apart. 100 years ago, kids in classrooms were taught the color of their skin was their most important characteristic. And if they looked a certain way, they were inferior. Today, kids are being taught that the color of their skin defines them again. And if they look a certain way, they're an oppressor. From colleges to corporations to our culture, people are making money and gaining power by pretending we haven't made any progress at all, by doubling down on the divisions we've worked so hard to heal. You know this stuff is wrong. Hear me clearly. America is not a racist country. It's backwards to fight discrimination with different types of discrimination, and it's wrong to try to use our painful past to dishonestly shut down debates in the present. I'm an African American who has voted in the South my entire life. I take voting rights personally. Republicans support making it easier to vote and harder to cheat, and so do the voters. It will be easier to vote early in Georgia than in Democrat-run New York. But the left doesn't want you to know that. They want people virtue signaling by yelling about a law they haven't even read. Fact checkers have called out the White House for misstatements. The president absurdly claims that this is worse than Jim Crow. What is going on here? I'll tell you, a Washington power grab.
Biden seems driven in finding ways to maintain the prison industrial complex, such as by banning menthol-flavored cigarettes.
Just saying no to menthol cigarettes. Those flavored cigarettes may be banned here in California and across the country.
Now, as Eyewitness News reporter Josh Haskell tells us, the state is looking to make them illegal in anticipation of a federal ban.
For years, anti-tobacco has argued black Americans have been disproportionately targeted by the menthol industry, and President Biden is preparing to do something about it. As part of Biden's efforts to reduce health disparities highlighted by the pandemic, the FDA is expected to ban menthol cigarettes and cigars, which is preferred by 85% of black cigarette smokers.
If the FDA really acts and takes these products off the market, it'll be real hard to have a black market because they won't be being manufactured anymore. Black people aren't manufacturing, just like we don't manufacture bullets, we don't manufacture cigarettes either, but they're all over our community.
And tobacco use is the number one cause of preventable death among black Americans, responsible for 45,000 deaths a year, according to the CDC. In a statement, Governor Newsom said, "I urge the federal government to follow California's leadership to protect public health and advance racial equity by moving to ban menthol-flavored cigarettes." But the ACLU and some racial justice advocates are concerned a ban will make black Americans targets. Menthol smoker and activist James Brown of South LA says a ban is not the answer.
We are already targets this anyway based on the color of our skin. Now, with us smoking menthol and that becoming a ban, that give police more probable cause to come and target us.
But those in favor of the ban, including the American Lung Association, say it will save lives.
The industry has racistly profiled us, and now they're flipping the script and saying to take these products off would be racist, when in fact what the racism was that initial targeting and the pernicious way that they did it. Obviously, we have some serious issues in our country, and so we've seen that no more evidence than this painful past year.
A ban on menthol cigarettes doesn't require congressional approval, but the well-funded tobacco industry has sued the FDA for years over anti-cigarette policy, and they will likely do so again.
Interestingly enough, in 2012, a research article was published in Yale School of Medicine magazine regarding a joint study between University of Connecticut School of Pharmacy and Yale. In the article, researchers showed that menthol cigarettes are more addictive than other types of cigarettes. The study was published online back in September 2012 in the Journal of the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology. Transylvania U or University of Pennsylvania? Which is it? University of Pennsylvania and Princeton are both guilty of profiting off of purloined bones from two children murdered by Philadelphia police during the MOVE bombing on May 13, 1985 that killed 11 members of the MOVE organization. Six of those murdered were children. The skeletal remains from those two children were Tree Africa and Delisa Africa. Tree's remains were used for an online course hosted by Penn Anthropology Museum Curator and Professor of Anthropology at Princeton, Professor Janet Meng. In addition to being used as teaching aids, the bones of the two children were also used for untold marrow experimentation, as well as being put on display in the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology. The bones were given to Princeton tenured professor and anthropologist Dr. Alan Mann in 1986, but not for identification, because that had already been completed by the Philadelphia Coroner's Office. Dr. Janet Meng, curator of Penn Museum, was using the bones in a four-pay forensic anthropology course that has since been removed from Coursera and YouTube. Dr. Mann still has the bones, but has refused to release them to surviving family members of MOVE. Penn has issued an apology on Twitter. Princeton president has not issued anything. Neither schools have offered any compensation. By the way, University of Penn keeps in storage some 1,000 plus remains of enslaved Aboriginal Americans, which were also used for unknown purposes by UPenn and other universities. Also, both Samuel George Morton Museum at University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, PA, and Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C., admitted to possessing at least 30,000 skeletal remains taken from desecrated burial grounds and gravesites of Aboriginal, aka so-called Black Americans.
This week, the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, known as the Penn Museum, apologized via Twitter, saying, quote, "We understand the importance of reuniting the remains with the family, and we're working now to find a respectful, consultative resolution." Princeton University President Christopher Eisgruber issued a statement saying he's, quote, "concerned over reports that the remains were used for instruction on campus," and said he would launch a fact-finding effort conducted by outside counsel. Earlier this week, Democracy Now! Spoke with Mike Africa Jr., a second-generation MOVE member who was 6 years old when Philadelphia police bombed the MOVE home.
I don't trust the Penn Museum. I don't trust Princeton. I definitely want to say that there's more to come with this. There needs to be accountability, because Penn's reaction to this is totally unprofessional, making an apology through a statement through someone else. And, you know, the whole thing is egregious.
This week, 70 Princeton professors, including Kiangi Amata Taylor, Imani Perry, and Eddie Glaude, signed on to a letter published in the campus newspaper calling on the university to act. The group writes, quote, "The university should move beyond denial to pursue restitution and repair. The victims of the MOVE bombing, their families, and those of us at Princeton invested in Black history and communities deserve more," they said.
Food and Drug Administration's Abundance of Caution proposal should extend to supplements. The FDA wants regulation of nutritional and medicinal supplements, according to an article by Sarah Green Carmichael on Bloomberg.com. In that article, she states the laws are lax because of bipartisan 1994 legislation, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, which mostly allows companies to regulate themselves. Supplement makers heavily favored the law, and no wonder. In the years after its passage, the number of supplements on the market skyrocketed. Between 1994 and 2019, the market quadrupled from $4 billion to $40 billion. The surge in CBD products is expected to keep this growth going. Ironically, not less than 5 months back, U.S. Republican Representative for Wisconsin, Glenn Grothman, introduced a House resolution in February of this year that recognizes the benefits of vitamin D supplement intake for preventing respiratory infection and COVID complications. Grothman introduced a House resolution, H.R. 116, that also encourages the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, and the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, to issue guidance on vitamin D intake for elderly and immunocompromised individuals during the ongoing so-called pandemic. The resolution details expert support for the benefits of vitamin D, including an overview of research suggesting D's benefits, as well as an open letter signed by 120 health science and medical experts from the UK, US, and Europe that was sent in December 2020 to world governments, asserting that there is clear scientific evidence that vitamin D supplements reduce COVID-19 infections, hospitalizations, and deaths. The results, or the resolution, also notes that 40% of American adults are vitamin D deficient, with deficiency rates within so-called African American and Latino populations ranging from 70% to 80%. And in a more virus-related furor, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on Friday that Canada may consider halting the arrival of international students into Ontario following a request from Ontario's Premier Doug Ford, adding that they will be reaching out to their officials today to formalize that request, unquote. Ford urged the Prime Minister to tighten international and provincial borders. Canada closed its U.S. land and sea borders to non-essential travelers over 1 year ago in an effort to curb spread of the virus. However, over the past few weeks, several provinces have called for tightened restrictions and measures when it comes to international travel. This ban or suspension announcement happens just weeks after Canada's IRCC announced its new immigration pathways for international students and essential workers.
Yesterday, the premiers and I had another productive meeting. We talked about vaccines, testing, and what we can do to beat this third wave. We also talked at length about borders. Premier Ford asked that we suspend the arrival of international students. Because at this time, Ontario is the only province requesting this, we're happy to work more narrowly with them. We'll be reaching out to their officials today to formalize that request. Again, I want to be clear. This is not the time to travel. On land borders, as a reminder, anyone who comes to the U.S. land border has already been tested in the U.S. in the last 3 days. Then they have to get tested again. And everyone has to quarantine for 2 weeks and do another test on day 8. We're enforcing very severe consequences for anyone breaking these rules. Yesterday, in addition to all this, Deputy Prime Minister Freeland provided an update on the budget as well. I also took the opportunity to congratulate Premier Silver of Yukon on his re-election. I look forward to continuing to work with him on everything from the fight against climate change and creating affordable childcare to our commitment on building a stronger relationship with Indigenous peoples. In fact, I'll be calling Sandy later today so we can discuss these priorities further. As I told everyone around the table last night, it's vital that we keep working together. We're following the situation with this third wave closely, especially in places that are hardest hit. Yesterday, Alberta reported their highest single-day total since the beginning of the pandemic. Premier Kenney announced new restrictions to slow the spread of the virus, and our government is ready to work with the province to provide support. For Ontario, medical teams from the Canadian Armed Forces began arriving in Toronto on Tuesday night, including critical care nurses who will work in the ICUs. This first deployment of 55 members of the forces will be providing assistance to Sunnybrook Hospital and its mobile units. On Tuesday as well, a healthcare team from Newfoundland and Labrador arrived in Ontario. They're helping at Toronto General Hospital. Like I said before, we are actively working with the Government of Ontario to determine how else we can support them. For Nova Scotia, where cases are also high, we've deployed 60 Canadian Armed Forces members to testing centres to help stop the spread of the virus. And for New Brunswick, we've approved the province's request for assistance for long-term care homes. The Red Cross will assist in up to 3 facilities until the end of June. Nunavut has also requested additional support to deal with their current outbreaks. We're moving quickly to keep people safe by sending more PPE and health equipment and by providing support for households in isolation who need food or mental health services. We're also engaging with other provinces that are hit hard by this third wave to see how we can help. We're ready to send any resources needed to protect you and your family. And of course, we're continuing to deliver PPE, rapid tests, and vaccines. So far, we've distributed more than 15 million doses of vaccines right across the country. Wednesday, almost 1 million doses arrived in Canada, including our first shipment of the single-dose Janssen vaccine. Starting next week, we will be receiving 2 million doses a week just from Pfizer alone. This will mark another major ramp up. We will continue to work with provinces and territories to get these doses to Canadians as quickly as possible.
That's Justin Trudeau addressing Canadians on Friday, April 30th, just 7 days prior to his decision to place a ban on flights from India and Pakistan, forcing many travelers from the two countries to seek refunds for booked travel arrangements. The weaponization of communication systems is very rarely spoken about in the media. There is a controversy surrounding AT&T with regards to billions in funding it received for its part in the development and deployment of a first responder telecom system called FirstNet. This exclusively private broadcast band network will incorporate a signal manipulation technology called beamforming. The allegations against AT&T and its CEO Randall L. Stephenson were published online in an ebook by Richard Lighthouse. Lighthouse claims that the AT&T and CEO Stephenson, who received billions for this project, are guilty of treason against the American people because there is evidence proving Stephenson et al. Knew that the technology was being used to harm specific groups of people. Allegedly, this beam-forming technology is being used to cause burns, audio hallucinations, or otherwise harass certain targeted people, such as whistleblowers. The story has been greatly ignored or suppressed by popular media, as I stated. A deep search on five different search engines and one library reference site produced little to no information about weaponized beamforming, also called spatial filtering. This might lead an inquisitive mind to either accept popular information or give up. However, there is a book by Athanasius Menikas called Beamforming: Sensor Signal Processing for Defense Applications, Communications and Signal Processing, published by Imperial College Press. I won't read the entire book description, but the title and description alone are very telling indeed. The limitations of beamforming mostly involve the computing resources it requires. There are many scenarios where the time and power resources required by beamforming calculations end up negating its advantages, but continuing improvements in processor power and efficiency have made beamforming techniques affordable enough to build into consumer network equipment. Beamforming is not new. Its technology has been spoken about and studied since the 1940s. And while I'm on the subject of space, wealthy tech capitalist and Tesla CEO Elon Musk said a bunch of people will probably die during Mars mission. It's not, quote-unquote, for everyone, he stressed, adding with a laugh, quote, volunteers only, unquote. Musk's space company has launched more than 100 rockets over the past decade in its effort to bring tourists to the moon and Mars, but a number of the unmanned prototypes have gone up in flames. And that, my dear listeners, is a wrap for edition number 2 of the Balanced Reality Report. Special thanks go out to field producer Chris R. and to our music, incidental music, from Arulo and Mixkit.co. Intro and outro music provided by Io Haya. And once again, thank you for listening to the Balanced Reality Report. I'm your presenter, Pharaoh. Until next time. Use of any third-party audio clip content is within compliance with the terms of fair use and the Copyright Act of 107. This report has been presented for informational and educational purposes only. If you wish to use copyrighted material from this report for purposes which go beyond fair use, you must obtain permission from the copyright owner.